I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm David Jenkins.
And I'm Hannah Strong.
On the show this week is a Challenges special. We dive deep into the subject of the latest issue of Little White Lies. I spoke to its writer, Justin Karitzkas, and we revisit Luca Guadagnino's earlier films, The Protagonist and A Bigger Splash, all coming up on Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Oh, welcome, welcome. The team behind one of the best issues I think you've maybe done. I absolutely adored it. And nice also to hear from everyone that all of the Challenges people adored it.
Yeah, I mean, we say every issue that this is the best one we've ever done. But I do think like this one we really, in terms of what we were able to pull off, but then also in terms of like the contributions from writers around the film, I was just blown away at how everyone really did like bring their A game. And it was particularly tense, I think, more so for David than for me, like waiting to find out if we were going to be able to get everyone involved that we wanted to have involved. And it all was very 11th hour. So I'm reluctant to take too much credit because David was really the one waiting in the late evenings to hear if he was getting an email from Mike Feist or not.
There was definitely some adrenaline pumping on this issue. And I think that, I mean, there was a kind of maybe 36-hour window in which the events that occurred within that time frame could have made it a very, very different issue. But it was just amazing that everyone kind of came on board and was obviously kind of, you know, I think I'd sort of spent a lot of time trying to kind of articulate what the mag is and what our vision is and how we were going to kind of present things and what we were going to do and how our kind of celebration was going to manifest. And, you know, quite late in the game, they just all suddenly like, yep, yeah, we're all on board. And then everyone dropped in very, very quickly. And yes, I had a situation where I was at home and I put my daughter to bed and then I kind of came out of that. And then about 10 minutes later, Zendaya called my mobile and I had to sit next door and have a very, very lovely conversation with her, actually. You know, she just so sharp, passionate, really, really inspired and into the film. And I mean, you know, I think with her as, you know, I think as a, I mean, we can get into this when we talk about the film, but as a producer on the film, there's definitely a sense of like, she's really, really fully in the tank. This is kind of her baby in many ways. And I think we've seen on with the various kind of red carpets across the world that she has kind of, you know, she's pulling out all the stops. Not to say that that everyone else isn't as well, but I mean, as you know, I guess she's the sort of focal point of the film in many ways. But yeah, no, it was a mad time. And really, really proud of what everyone pulled off on this one.
I mean, it feels like the press tour is like almost as much fun and joyful as the film itself, almost as artful. Like really, I mean, what she does with, I believe her stylist is called Laura Roach, like in terms of referencing fashion history, theming things and just like having an incredible time with it is, she's just a joy in this world. I would say even as a card-carrying member of the Josh O'Connor fan club, some other choices were made, which perhaps were not quite as compelling as what Zendaya was bringing to the red carpet, but I'll forgive him in this instance. if only for his styling in La Chimera.
Yeah, I mean, I think Josh is incredibly stylish, and his partnership with Jonathan Anderson as a Loewe boy, I think, has been incredibly fruitful. Yeah, I mean, I feel sorry for is Mike Feist, because some of his looks across, predominantly it's across like the photo shoots that we've seen this press tour, I'm just like, I feel like they're doing you a bit dirty, my man. Like, we got to get you like a stylist who knows what they're doing.
But do you know what? I see what you're saying, but I kind of feel it's a really good reflection of the film. It's almost like a kind of inside baseball-y kind of, you know, he is the sort of demure straight guy in many ways. And these other people are the kind of extroverts. But, you know, I guess some people just, it isn't necessarily their thing to be like, you know, serving looks on a red carpet.
Mike's a theatre boy.
I guess, yeah, yeah. All singing, looks. All dancing Mike Feist. I don't know that we can be like, oh yes, the little wallflower that he is.
But I mean, yeah, maybe that it is like a, you know, they're trying to tell a story. I think, you know, since the Barbie fashion, like the press tour around that, I feel like, and even like Anya Taylor-Joy, who had the same stylist as Zendaya for a while, like I think there's more thought going into these things now, or maybe going back to an older age of like, you know, kind of tying together film press with like the film itself. And I love that. I'm here for the kind of theatricality of it all. And yeah, Zendaya's like the tennis themed looks and the kind of like athleisure looks have been really cool. I think she's so cool. I just want to be friends with her. She would never be friends with me. I'm not cool enough to be friends with Zendaya, but like, yeah, I just think she's like radiant. I love her.
She's almost like, and it's kind of a weird thing to say, but like, she's almost better than anything that she's done, I would say, until now. I remember, you know, there was some sort of like silly listicle or some article that I read that was all about like the best actors who have never won an Oscar. And she was on that list. You know, she's very young. I'm sure she'll be an EGOT by the time she's 40. But there was this like idea of like, oh, she probably should have won something by now. And there is that sense, because you can kind of see how talented she is. But their like kind of suggestion for like the one that got away was like Malcolm and Marie, and I was like, okay, yeah, I think if anything this reflects that we've kind of been underserving.
Yeah, I mean, I saw Euphoria and I thought it was, you know, it's pretty good for what it is. It's like teen drama and she does very, you know, good work in it. But I think, yeah, the Challenges is like the first time where I think she's had a role that kind of matches like her energy. And obviously she, you know, in the interview she talks about how involved she was in producing it, and I think like one of the things that's very exciting about her is that she seems so kind of all in. Like, she, you know, she's not just someone who goes home at the end of the day and this is like, you know, oh yeah, I did my 8 hours on set. You know, she wants to kind of be involved in like changing the role, the type of roles that are out there for like particularly for young women of color. And I think she's really cool. I love her and Tom Holland as a couple. I think they seem very cute together. And I am delighted at what she kind of brought to Challenges, because this really was like her baby. Like, she brought in Luca, you know, she brought in Josh and Mike. So it's, you know, I think if anything, she's maybe not getting enough credit for kind of being the person that like really shepherded this film. Like,
I do wonder if this is going to have a kind of very like one of those very kind of long tail things where it's going to kind of crop up again come kind of Christmas 2025 award season. Because I think if this does well, which it seems like it's going to, then, you know, it ticks so many boxes. You know, it's like it's got those big performances, and, you know, it's got that kind of weird thing as well where they're all leads and they're all supporting. So you can kind of, you know, you can do some category fiddling as well if you wanted. But yeah, I mean, if at the end of the day Zendaya gets like a nomination for lead actress for this, then the film would have been like a complete success. Even if she doesn't win, I think it will give her that kind of, in the same way that kind of Lily Gladstone did, you know, got that kind of focus for Killers of the Flower Moon. You know, it's sort of like announcing her as I'm a leading lady, you know.
And also not a child star. Because exactly. I think even like Euphoria, it's like she's still playing like a teenager. And Malcolm Marie, which she also produced, I think kind of started making that transition, but it's such a bad film. It's kind of difficult to take seriously. Whereas this, I think, is a very unequivocal like line in the sand. It's like, this is the caliber of work that I can do and that I should be doing. So yeah, I mean, we're going to get into it now about the film itself, but like, just as kind of an artifact, I think it is interesting. And it's also like, for Luca, I think it feels like a much more like commercial minded film, which I'm sure he would vehemently disagree with, but yeah, I mean, especially because we might get another Luca film this year if Queer ends up happening. I mean, I really, really like him as a filmmaker and as a person. He's so blunt and so kind of unapologetic, and I have such fun with his films. I mean, we're about to dive in, but yeah, I do think like when I saw Challengers for the first time, it was just like 2 hours of just like luxurious escapism. And you know,
I was there. You could kind of feel it radiating off you. Like, I was just almost, you know, somehow. I don't know whether your body language or perhaps there was some
sort of like leaning forward. I was like,
this is a person having a grand old time.
Yeah. And the same thing when I saw it a second time, you know, I just had such a ball with it, you know.
Well, no pun. I mean, I hope that they don't do the compromise of the supporting actress, because I feel like that would be a real dip. Betrayal of like Tashi herself.
Yeah,
she would not accept that.
But anyway, we should get into it. There's like so much joy to be had in discussing Challengers.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach after a career-ending injury, is married to a champion on a losing streak. Her strategy for her husband's redemption takes a surprising turn when he must face off against his former best friend, who is also Tashi's former boyfriend. But before we get into the film, here's my conversation with its writer, Justin.
How are you doing?
I'm really good. Most obvious question to begin with. Why tennis?
Yeah. Well, the inspiration for the movie sort of came from watching this match with Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka mm-hmm. at the 2018 US Open final. And I, prior to that, had not been a massive tennis fan or really a sports fan generally. I just kind of happened to turn it on. And there was this really controversial call where Serena Williams was accused of receiving coaching from mm-hmm. the sidelines. And I had never heard of that rule, but immediately it struck me as really intensely cinematic, that you're all alone on this court, and the only other person in the stadium who cares as much about what happens to you as you do is somebody you can't even speak to. And I started to think, what if you had to talk about something that was beyond tennis? It was about your lives. It was really high stakes for you personally. How could you do that using the language of film? And so that idea got planted, and then parallel to that, as I was already starting to think about the movie, I became a legitimate obsessive tennis fan and was like, couldn't get enough of it. You know, like it was sort of becoming the only thing that was holding my attention. It was just better than movies. It was better than TV. And I was so sort of hungry for tennis that I started watching not just the Grand Slams, but even these low-level challenger events, which not a lot of people watch, mm-hmm. which are like filmed with one camera, like a kind of webcam looking thing in the back. And that's when it really clicked to me that, oh, that would be an interesting place to set a sports movie in this low stakes, you know, no money, no fame, no nothing tournament.
I mean, it does seem something kind of particular to tennis where there's almost always a person behind that's like really pushing someone. I don't know if you read Andre Agassi's biography or Williams Sisters. It's like the role of the coach is much, much kind of stronger.
Well, that's the thing about tennis. There's a myth of you being alone mm-hmm. because it looks very much like two people who are completely, like radically alone in this massive stadium. But mm-hmm. of course, we all know that you're playing for more than just one person when you're playing. And in fact, when you watch tennis, they always cut to the box. You know, mm. I remember watching Federer and Djokovic at Wimbledon and, you know, it was like this 5-hour match that went into whatever, how many tie breaks. Mm. And they kept cutting to Federer's wife, who used to be a player. And she was like so stressed out, you know, she looked like she was playing the match. And that was really inspiring to me, too, because I was thinking, what's going on with her? Why is this so emotional for her beyond, you know, that being her husband or somebody she cares about? Yeah. You could really tell that she was playing tennis, you know, even as she was sitting there.
And so the idea of this kind of then be a jumping off point for like a love triangle and one like, you know, and also like an interracial love triangle also come quite early on.
Yeah, well, that aspect of it was really about, but I knew it was about American tennis players. Mm-hmm. And you can't really tell the story of American tennis without telling the story of Black women, because that has been the story of women's tennis in America, you know, for the past however many decades. Mm-hmm. So I kind of knew that very early on. In terms of the love triangle of it, I think there's something really erotically charged about tennis in that it's like boxing, but where instead of trying to touch each other, you're trying not to touch each other, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot of repression in that. It's almost like a Victorian novel or something, you know, there's people trying not to make contact. And yet, at the same time, it's so intense and so emotional and so physical, but so restrained. So that kind of, that contrast I found really sexy.
Yeah.
And I was, you know, trying to figure out what kind of story could best exploit that.
I think my first note when I came out was I just couldn't stop thinking about the Freud quote of like everything in life is about sex except for sex, which is about power. And I was like, it kind of doesn't have explicit sex in it, but everything in it is a sex scene in a way.
I completely agree. Yeah.
I mean, what was the decision to kind of not have the sort of straightforward conventional sex scene, but rather you just kind of fill it with kind of like sexually charged dynamics?
Well, I think so much of the both emotional and erotic charge of the movie is happening on the court. And I think that's where these people are fully themselves. That's where they can say things to each other that they can't in person. You know, they can't using their words. And that was always such a draw for me with the film in the first place. It's kind of what made me want to write it, was the idea of people having a conversation through action. And so I think it was important to me that the most intimate feeling we ever had watching the movie was when they were all playing tennis, when they all had rackets in their hands.
It's fascinating because it's kind of also just like the kind of one of the few sports, I suppose, where like men and women have a kind of equal interest in themselves.
Absolutely.
And so it kind of wouldn't work without, it can be like a legitimate power dynamic with them. She can be the bigger star than them at points.
That's really important. Yeah. Women's tennis stars are just as famous. They get paid just as well for the most part at the Grand Slams, at least, as the men. And it's one of the few sports in the world that operates that way. So you're absolutely right. That was a really important part of choosing that setting.
And in terms of the structure, sorry, I feel like I'm just asking way too many questions about tennis, but like,
ask whatever you want.
In terms of the structure where you're kind of jumping back and forth so often, and it's, you know, what was that an element that came in as well? And what was the sort of purpose of that?
Well, the desire I had to write the film, it was really about like creating a movie I wanted to watch. And what I was realizing as I was becoming this massive tennis fan was that I wanted to write something that would be as engaging as tennis. And at the same time, I was asking myself, well, what would make tennis even better? Because it was really my favorite thing in the world to watch. Mm-hmm. And for me, the answer of what would make tennis even better was I wanted to know on a microscopic level what was at stake for everybody at every point. You know, if I could watch a tennis match and the commentators could like whisper in my ear, here's exactly why he's upset right now. You know, that was like my dream, just from like a totally hedonistic point of view. Like I wanted that pleasure for myself. So because that was kind of the inspiration, the structure came naturally out of that, because I knew that I wanted to throw people right into the match and then gradually make the match more meaningful to them as they watched, because that's what I wanted to have. That's the experience I wanted to have. So it was kind of a natural thing that ended up being the structure.
In terms of then, you know, working with Luca and the actors, there's quite a few kind of details that aren't in there, even just in terms of like character story. I mean, like I found myself thinking for days, like, why is Patrick not asking his parents for money? And we never find out. But like, were those details like already mapped out for you and you were able to kind of tell them that, or did you want to give them a bit of room to sort of develop their own ideas?
A bit of both. You know, I knew the characters pretty well, but of course, Luca's one of those people who's, he won't let anything sit if he has a question about something. You know, the way that he would deal with pre-productions, we would just read through the script and he would stop with the whole, all of the department heads. Mm-hmm. He would stop anytime he didn't understand something or anytime he had a question about something, and he would turn to me and go, why did you do it that way? You know, and then you'd have to answer. And sometimes you have the answer and sometimes you don't. And when you don't, you find the answer together. When it comes to the question of class or how that operates in the movie, one of the most surprising and kind of joyful things to work through in pre-production was working with Jonathan, the costume designer and, you know, the great fashion designer, mm-hmm. Because he had such specific ideas about the story that these people's clothing would tell about where they come from and who they are. And so with Patrick specifically, he and I talked a lot about that, about the exact type of rich guy Patrick was and the kind of entitlement and privilege that he comes from.
The I Told You t-shirt, that's a JFK Jr. reference, is that right? No. See, told you I liked the movie. I did a lot of reading up.
There you go.
So it kind of was supposed to be like kind of positioning him as sort of being that sort of Camelot, kind of, I suppose, for America, old money.
Absolutely, yeah.
And yeah, I'm just wondering what the additional weight was, because I was at Venice. The weight was with the film being coming out, because I was at Venice, and when we learned that it wasn't coming,
yeah,
it was, you could practically hear the screams of 1,000 film critics.
But, yeah.
I mean, how was that experience for you, having to kind of give it, what is it, 7 months later?
Yeah, I was so excited to go to Venice. It was a total bummer. But I actually am more excited that it's coming out now. I think it's, you know, it was a tough thing to wait, but it feels really good to be able to release it with everybody being able to show up and be a part of it. You know, I mean, I wouldn't have been able to participate. The actors wouldn't have been able to participate. And it was such a labor of love for all of us that we all went through together. So to be able to support it together is really, I think, important.
I mean, it does seem to be one of those films where people who have already seen it are like, oh, okay, this is my new personality.
Great.
Like, they love it so much. But, I mean, have you been surprised at all with some of the reactions to it?
I mean, yeah, I'm not surprised. I kind of knew once we had Zendaya and the rest of the cast and Luca that people were going to be excited about it because people are rightfully excited about all those people. But yeah, I get surprised by the amount of it sometimes, for sure.
And I just also wanted to ask about your next collab with Luca. It's William S. Burroughs as well, one of the least filmable novelists in some ways. I mean, what was the choice to go down that route?
Well, that was a movie that Luca has wanted to make since he was a teenager, when he first read the book. Because that book was written in the 50s, but it didn't come out until the 80s. And that's when I think Luca encountered it. And so it had been this project that he was really looking to do for a long time. And I was like incredibly honored and grateful that he asked me to be a part of it. It was a really amazing thing to be handed this book by this legendary author, by this legendary director, mm-hmm. and have him say, read this tonight and tell me if you want to write it. And so I read it. And I told him, yeah, I'm in. And that was it.
Oh, so you weren't a huge Burroughs fan beforehand? Because, I mean, I've only read Naked Lunch.
You know, it was a big... Yeah, I had read Naked Lunch as a teenager. That's kind of... I think that's when a lot of people encounter Burroughs. He's like one of those guys. Mm-hmm. And I was completely blown away by it. But I hadn't read Queer. Because Queer is a bit of a deep cut mm-hmm. In the Burroughs canon. I mean, if you love Burroughs, you know about that book. But... I hadn't read it, and I was really surprised reading it that it's a love story, you know. For Burroughs, at least, a fairly straightforward love story. Mm-hmm. So I could see a path to making it a movie, and so could Luca. And so we worked really closely together on that script.
Well, thank you so much. I mean, that's incredible. I'm really excited to watch that now. But great. I mean, I suppose yeah,
I can't wait
the
for
delay.
You to see it.
And I'm so glad that you like the issue as well.
The issue is amazing.
The team will be absolutely thrilled.
No, it's so cool.
Thank you so much.
Lovely to meet you.
So, Hannah, the person who could not even contain her joy during the screening of Challengers. Yeah, beyond having a grand old time, do you think there's a more kind of substance behind this?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it is like a big, fun film. And I have seen some people been like, oh, yeah, I had a really good time, but like, I'm not really gonna, you know, think about it much after the fact, which I accept that as a kind of take on it. But I'm a big fan of like kind of films that have a dynamic between, like, you know, well, the kind of love triangle dynamic, but also the just the kind of like very quick fire dialogue. And this is like, as a script, it's very quippy and very back and forth, and there's a kind of symmetry between the tennis matches and like all the kind of dialogue scenes in the film, whether it's between Josh O'Connor and Mike Feist, who are Patrick and Art, or between Patrick and Tashi, or Tashi and Art. It's, you know, every conversation is almost like you're watching a tennis match going on. Some of them are more obvious than others, but it just felt like there was a real kind of pace to the film. And I have thought about it a lot, like, since I saw it, just because I'm fascinated by these characters. And I did see some people kind of being like, oh, well, Tashi, we don't really know enough about her as like a character. But I didn't mind that so much, because I think she's the kind of woman that is like very withholding. And I think particularly for sports women, you know, it is difficult to kind of shape a public persona. I mean, I'm thinking about like Venus and Serena Williams, and the kind of, you know, their history as like public figures was so kind of, I don't know, unfair, and there were so many kind of barriers they had to overcome. And you know, they're two of the kind of greatest like tennis players of all time, full stop, like even including men. So it's, you know, I think that is actually kind of reflective of how female sports stars have to kind of, I don't know, almost withhold a little bit in order to get ahead, which sucks. But I do think it is an interesting commentary that Justin has kind of got across. But at the same time, I'm not like a tennis person. I've maybe watched like, I don't know, 3 matches in my life, and I found the film very like accessible. I didn't think, you know, even though I don't really understand how a tennis match works, it didn't really hinder my enjoyment. So I think that was like a big plus, a big check in the positive column, because I do find sports movies sometimes are a bit difficult to, you know, even something like Moneyball, I really struggle with because I don't understand baseball.
So you, I'm like sitting stats? There like,
I mean, I do like Moneyball, and I did, you know, I found it interesting, but I was kind of like, I did, you know, that meme of like the woman with all the numbers in front of her, that was like me trying to watch Moneyball. But yeah, this is I think it is about tennis, and it's not about tennis. So I found it, yeah, that there's kind of just so much to get in, a rich text, as a friend of the podcast Mark Ash would refer to it. I just think there's so much kind of going on in this film, and I was so involved in all of it. And we've had conversations about like, oh, in the original script there was like different things, and in the cut that was seen last year there was like a more explicit sex scene and stuff, and it's like, yeah, there's, I don't know, it feels like there's law around this film, which I don't know, I find very fitting with the kind of juicy plot going on.
Yeah, but I think that sort of reflects the way that, like, I'm a kind of a fair weather tennis person, but I think that reflects the way that, like, tennis in itself can become, like, such a very exciting and quite, like, a cinematic experience. Because if you sort of choose a villain, and if you sort of, like, come to any of these matches with sort of, like, quite a, like, you know, like, quite, you know, strong ideas about who these people are, like,
yeah,
if, like me, you hate Djokovic.
I was going to say,
fascinated by the sort of passing of the baton that's happening between Serena Williams and Naomi Osaka, like, then every stroke feels like a metaphor.
Which, yeah, I guess that is very similar in the film. Like, there's an investment in the characters and the kind of the villainy, which I think is like, because I've seen some people saying like, oh, like the character of Art is kind of, you know, a little bit lost in the film, and like he's not compared to Tashi and Patrick, he's like a bit of an innocent character. And I'm like, I mean, no, Art does some kind of shady things in particularly in the kind of like beginning of the narrative, but that, I mean, like you say, like if you know, you choose your villain and you kind of construct like a narrative.
Loved Agassi and I hated Sampras, and that was enough to kind of keep me coming back to watch. But like, David, I'm, for a film that's kind of at its core about sex or sexual tension. It's a film that doesn't have any sex in it. Like, how do you think that sort of as a choice worked?
Well, I mean, it doesn't have like literal, like, I guess, how, like, humping, I guess. Sorry to use that term on this podcast, kids. But it strikes me that Luca himself is kind of, I mean, I spoke to him and I kind of approached this idea with him about, like, you know, there is a lot of the film has this kind of sense of innuendo and everything is imbued with sort of sexuality and like references and, like, you know, a sense of the erotic. And, you know, he kind of batted it away a bit, but I could kind of understand why, of like not necessarily wanting to give that game away, because it's a very, it is a very kind of hot film in that sense that, you know, it's sort of doing a lot with like how he shoots people's bodies and what camera angles he is using and what clothes that people are wearing at certain points in certain conversations, and, you know, the makeup and all that kind of stuff is done in a way that is very, very kind of everything has been kind of sexually heightened and charged to a kind of almost breaking point level. You know, you're kind of like teetering on the verge of like it becoming some kind of expressionist artwork. You know, that there is almost like a sort of surreal element to the way that people sweat, and there are shots of like Josh O'Connor and Mike Faced during their kind of big match where they decide to, like, in during one of the breaks, they take their t-shirts off and they genuinely look like plastic models. Like they don't look human, but in a kind of almost kind of comically overcharged erotic way. Everything is sexually charged without, you know, you not needing like a sex scene. And I mean, it's interesting because, you know, we have this, like, there seems to be this kind of circular conversation that occurs on social media of like someone piping up going, why do we need sex scenes in films? Well, they don't serve any function. And, you know, I think that this is either going to like freak those people out completely when you're sort of like, what if the whole film was a sex scene, or at least designed and shot like a sex scene? And in fact, on that note, actually, like, one of the criticisms, like, not a criticism, but one of the sort of things that a fair few people, mainly like, I think male critics have pointed up, is like that there is a kind of, like, occasionally like pornographic aesthetic. Maybe I think it's sort of, yeah, it's certainly a sex positive film, but like, yeah, there is definitely a feeling of like, yeah, it's there is maybe some nudges to the kind of glossy perfection that you might see in like pornographic film as well. But yeah, it's, I guess that answers your question a little bit, but yeah, no sex, but lots of sex.
Well, I mean, I think it was a note that I made during the first time I saw it, and then also one that I think it was tweeted out with the review of, like, that everything in life is about sex except for sex, which is about power. So it kind of is almost like sexier because we don't have sex, because sex would be about power.
Well, yeah, and she says, like, Tashi says, like, there's an argument she has, or not really, it is an argument, but it's also like a heated discussion she has with Patrick kind of midway through the film. It's like a flashback scene and they're talking about tennis, but they're talking about sex. And Patrick says, are we still talking about tennis? And she says, we're always talking about tennis, like, very kind of earnestly. And that's what there's this kind of like playfulness and innuendo. And I mean, there's a wonderful line from the interview with Luca where you don't even ask him about, do you ask him about the churro? Or does he just say it kind of off?
No, I sort of say, what, there is some kind of sexual symbolism in the film, and then he brought that up.
He brought up, yeah, we won't spoil it for the listeners, because it is like a delightful moment in the film. But there's a kind of pivotal scene involving churros, and Luca said in the interview, a churro is a churro is a churro, which is kind of like, I don't know, that could be the tagline of the film, because, you know, there's so much kind of, yeah, playfulness that runs throughout. Even like the ending I find so kind of, I don't know, it's almost like cutting you off before the climax, but that almost, you know, it makes it kind of better in my way.
Hannah's got an edging thing for something that we learned today.
God, this episode's really taken a turn and we're only 23 minutes in. I don't know. I find it frustrating when I've seen people, one of the kind of complaints on social media about the film is, oh, it's a sexy film without sex. And I'm like, why are you complaining about that? I think that's great. I think that eroticism is something that, like, we're kind of seeing less and less in cinema, especially mainstream cinema, especially cinema starring like a former Disney kid. I'm like, this is great. Like, you know, this is the kind of film studios should be making. You know, it's something that you would watch as like a 14-year-old and be like, oh my god, something in my brain has just tripped. Like, it's, yeah, you know,
what is Dwayne The Rock Johnson so afraid of that he won't be horny for a single other person in any of his films?
A long time ago I pitched an article to a publication of repute, shall we say, about that very subject, called like, why won't Dwayne The Rock Johnson have sex on screen? They didn't take it. But it is a question that, like, I think is worth asking, is, you know, even the suggestion of sex in, like, kind of mainstream cinema is so, like, it feels like it's such a kind of insane thing to a lot of viewers. And I feel my challenges, I think, I don't know, it pushes the envelope without pushing the envelope, if you see what I mean. Although there is some poor frontal nudity. There's, like, a locker room scene where this guy's just, like, hanging around with their dicks out, we should say, for anyone that was going to take their parents to see this movie. But I mean, yeah, this, even like the Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross score, and we've talked about them so much on this podcast because they're like two of the kind of greatest composers working. I mean, I love Nine Inch Nails anyway, and two of the greatest musicians of all time, but their score work just never misses. And the kind of like pumping electro score here is, even that is like, it's sexy, you know?
Oh my God, I loved it. You know, I'm a big Jaws person, but like the fact that we basically had almost quite a similar to a Jaws theme, but just to announce horniness anytime, like, David, like, sorry, not to just kind of make a sound like a lot of kind of like teenage boys, but the structure of this is also very interesting. It sort of reminded me of like Tristram Shandy, where you're sort of going back and forth, and like in that novel, he's not even been born by the time it ends, and essentially, in some ways, this is taking place over an entire, just over one tennis match, which isn't over by the time it ends in some regards. But like, we're going back and forth, just giving like context. I mean, like, how did you feel that sort of added to it?
Yeah, no, it's a really ingenious structure. And I think, you know, big props to writer Justin Karitzkis.
Who is the subject of Past Lives.
Yeah, well, who has not only sort of whipped up some really kind of fruity, tangy dialogue for the film, but has created this really like intriguing flashback structure of like, essentially, you have this kind of, you know, three-way relationship, and it kind of waxing and waning and moving in one direction and moving in the other direction. And they love each other and they hate each other. And then they have like, you know, these kind of dormant feelings that come to fruition at various points. But what the film is kind of doing in its essence is like, you know, it is a hymn to this idea of like any sports match, and any people who are playing sports are not, then they're just not able to disconnect themselves from their lives and the world. Like, that it's an impossible thing to do. You bring psychological baggage, you have relationships with the people you're playing against. There are kind of codes and strictures that are kind of invisible, imperceptible in some cases, but like they're constantly there. The idea of the film is like, you know, it's sort of bringing this like, this idea of like, it's kind of, you're watching this match, and then like the amount of baggage that each player and Tashi as the spectator is bringing to this match is just big. It's sort of like almost to a comic level being like piled up until by the end, it's just like the you know, it's just crazy. Like it's almost kind of incomprehensible. Like, you know, like that these people are just completely like, you know, in this wild and weird situation that where they kind of love each other and they hate each other, and you kind of, you just don't know what kind of climax you're going to get at the end. But Yeah, it's really kind of ingenious in that aspect, I think.
God, I so recommend as a chaser, and I, you know, I don't get to do the one last thing recommendation, but read Andre Agassi's biography after this, because honestly, if anything, it underplays how psychologically fraught it is. And the man hates tennis more than anything in the entire world. It's all just psychological torment and like weird relationships he's created in his head with his people that he's like deemed his nemesis, and like weird stuff with his dad. Sorry, slightly digress.
No, because Justin mentioned this in your interview, right, as well, David?
Yeah. No, I did. I did actually ask him about that. Because that's like. So I haven't actually read the book, but it's one of my wife's favorite books, and she's basically reading it and like paraphrasing pretty much every single page, going, "Oh my god, oh my god." And so,
oh my
like,
god, nobody hates tennis more than Andre Agassi. What a twist!
But yeah, no, it was an influence on the film. Yeah, he said it was like, he'd read it and definitely fed into the ideas and the structure and the characters.
I was saying the other day that I would love someone like to sit down with, maybe like, I think Andy Murray would be very funny. And
well, also as someone that like gives women their props.
Exactly.
Because every time they try and give him his, they're just like, oh, you've accomplished this thing. He's like, Serena did it.
Yeah.
I feel like the gender dynamics between the way that it's like portrayed in the media is quite different from how they actually as tennis players feel about one another.
Certainly some tennis players. I mean, Andy Murray is very good at that. And I would love to get like his read on this film. Because I would just kind of love to hear from, like, you know, the top kind of ranked tennis players how this reflects their own experience. Because I always love that kind of thing when you get like those articles that are like, we sat down with a nun to watch Immaculate or something. I just find that stuff really fun. And especially with tennis, because I do, there have been like a surprising kind of number of tennis films. Like, in fact, there was that wonderful tweet that someone did asking, like, why is there a career trajectory from playing Mary Jane Watson in a Spider-Man film to playing a tennis player? Because Kirsten Dunst...
Oh, yeah, yes, Emma Stone, that's three for three.
Yeah, Zendaya have all done it.
Yeah, because, the one from the Spider-Verse, she's not technically Mary Jane Watson, but yes, no, that's three
Zoe
for three.
When Zoe Kravitz does
it. They all get together
it.
And then they all play tennis players.
Zoe Kravitz is the only holdout, yeah, from Spider-Verse. This is my appeal. If anyone knows Andy Murray or any similar top flight tennis player, can we get a little vibe check from them? And I think Andy Murray would be very candid about it. He doesn't care now, like, you know, he's been in the game long enough.
No, we should get the Agassi ghostwriter to come see that biography. I'd read that. I read his mum's biography, which is like,
wow.
But yeah, no, before, let's not go down that rabbit hole. David, do you want to give some scores on this in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Okay, I'm going to give... So if I'm being honest, I'm going to say my anticipation was maybe a little bit more muted because... Actually, I'm probably going to say it's a 4 because, like, I'm sometimes a little mixed on Luca's films, and I'm kind of all over the map. So with every new film I encounter of his, there is a tiny bit of trepidation. So probably like a 4 because I actually think the cast in this does elevate it to that level of like, well, actually, you know, that's gonna help sweeten the pill. And yeah, probably like 5s. It's like a really like it's just you know I was kind of baffled by how much fun I was having watching this the first time, and thought like I just spent the whole time watching it thinking, when is this going to get bad? When is this going to go wrong? And it just sort of never does. And it's not a short film. It's like over 2 hours, and it really like sort of sustains it. You know, it's so rare that a film does that these days, that doesn't have a big section where it's like this lagged or this just didn't need to be here. And it's like it's just. It's very consistently fun over a long period of time, which is just like very difficult thing to do.
I think I'm in agreement, probably like a 4, 5, 5. As much as I'm just like, oh, you know, fun, and maybe I should sort of only kind of ascribe that sort of top score to things that have like sort of harrowed me. Like, this was gorgeous. I loved it. I loved it. I loved it. I love it more in retrospect. I can't wait to see it again. Hannah?
Yeah, no, I'm the same. When I was doing a review for the website, I was very much in a similar mind to you, being like, well, I don't know. I feel like I should reserve 5 for like kind of, you know, films that have had an earth-shattering impact upon me. But I think sometimes you've got to think about why you go to the cinema and what you want from a cinematic experience. And this is what I want. You know, sometimes you just want to be kind of wrapped up in this like gorgeous spectacle. And you know that tweet that's like, why must a movie be good? Is it not just enough to see a beautiful face huge? And that's kind of how I feel about this. I'm like, yeah, just gorgeous people being catty and horrible to one another, but also like there's such kind of a wealth of like love in it as well. It is a love story at the end of the day. They do all love each other, and that's like kind of the problem, is you know that their lives are so messy and enmeshed and they can't.
What makes you think that Tashi wants people to fall in love with her?
I think she does, but she like doesn't care, you know. I don't know. We could spend a whole podcast just dissecting the psychology of Tashi, Art and Patrick, I'm sure. But yeah, just on every kind of level, I just, everything comes together so beautifully in a way that I agree with David that I don't always vibe with Luca. As much as I like him as a person, I think he's very funny, and one of my favorite interviews ever was speaking to him for Bones and All, because he really, if he doesn't like your question, he's not going to pretend he likes your question. He's going to be like, nah, I don't like that, next. And I just think he's very honest, and I respect that about him. And in this film, it really all kind of meshed together so well. And I didn't realize that Justin is writing or has written his next film either, which makes me even more excited, because I can just imagine like a Daniel Craig delivering that kind of, you know, the delicious like bitchy dialogue that Justin does very well. So yeah, I'm 4/5/5, very much a hearty recommendation from me, and like good luck getting the song, the credit song, out of your head after you watch it, because it's very catchy.
So next up, you guys have chosen some Luca films for us to discuss. So first up, David, it's The Protagonist.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The film chronicles an Italian film crew who are in London making a reconstruction of the real-life killing of Egyptian chef Mohammed El-Sayed by the two 19-year-olds Jamie Petrolioli and Richard Alsay in 1994. David, why do you think those who are maybe not sated in their Luca worlds after challenges should seek out the protagonists?
Well, I watched this as a kind of bit of deep background ahead of my interview with Luca, because it was like a film of I think a lot of people assume that I Am Love was his debut, and he actually had made like two features and loads of shorts prior to that. And I Am Love is a very different type of film to the protagonist, but the connective tissue being his collaboration with Tilda Swinton. The Protagonist is a strange film and definitely the work of a kind of young director trying to sort of push boundaries and find a story and try to sort of use the language of cinema in a way that's not, that is as unconventional as possible. It's an imperfect film in many ways, but it's a very intriguing one in that it's this kind of meta documentary about this, what was at the time, well, in the sort of mid early 90s, a very kind of high profile case of these two guys who were ex-army, and they had I think PTSD or some sort of mental illness had sort of developed from being in the army, and they began this kind of strange role play where that culminated in them literally picking a random car that had stopped at a red light on a street in London, jumping into the back seat and then stabbing the driver, who happened to be this Egyptian restaurateur. And the film is kind of trying to look like it's trying to explore the situation, like what actually happened. And there's like it looks at how the filmmakers are talking about the morality of like reconstructing it. Tilda Swinton is being her most Tildery as a kind of MC who is, you know, almost sort of narrating things and bringing all these kind of parts together and doing interviews with people, like real people as well. So there's definitely a kind of weird mix of performance and documentary happening. I think ethically it's definitely on the kind of dodgy terrain here, in that it sort of almost has this very sort of starry-eyed view of these murderers who have done something really quite grim. And you know, I think it's maybe trying to comment on how cinema naturally tries to sort of romanticize horrific murders like this and dramatize them, and it's almost like it's sort of saying that, but it's sort of guilty of doing it as well. So yeah, it's a very strange film. It's kind of all over the place structurally as well. But yeah, it's on Amazon Prime, and you know, I think it's definitely worth a watch. It's by no means like a non interesting film. It's really kind of like, okay, this is interesting. I can see what you're doing here. But it does feel like a sort of not a failed experiment, but a kind of experiment that has given some limited results, shall we say. But it's very interesting. Like you said, there's a very, very brief shot of like Luca, as a, you know, he must have been like in his late 20s doing this. So yeah, he's seen very suddenly and looking very, very young. So that's quite a fun little moment in the film.
Well, I mean, I feel like given that we're kind of all bets are off with the structure, maybe you should follow up your Luca movie recommendation with your non-movie recommendation. Like, so if you're not going to watch Lucas, what is it that you're going to suggest people seek out?
Oh, interesting. Oh, we're going to mix it up. Okay, so this is my non-movie recommendation now. Okay, fine. Well, all right, I'll be very quick then. I have, through peer pressure, started to watch a show called It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
And
within the last month, and
what did you think a gorilla mask was prior?
I don't get that joke yet, because I'm still in the very early stages. But yeah, I think I was always daunted by the fact that there was like 20 series of it, and it was like if you kind of dive in, then you're going to have to give over a lot of time. But it does. It's a really nice thing to watch, like two episodes a day while you're eating your tea or chopping your veg or something. And it's you know, it's reliably funny and silly and controversial. And you know, I think it's a really good, like, you know, I think we could probably say so much more about this show, but like the thing that I think that is connected with me, and I'm coming at it from a relative vacuum in terms of like the fame of the people involved and the all these offshoots that they have, like podcasts and everything. So I'm coming at it like with no like prior knowledge, but it's like a real like actor showcase sitcom, and it's one of those things that I think one of the like from certainly like watching like the three series now, that it's a film that kind of lives or dies on the quality of the performances and that like the real kind of like comic timing. I think yeah, there are other elements at play as well, but I think like it's just like I find the performances and very enjoyable. And like the thing that's probably gonna get me to keep coming back, Charlie Day and DeVito are perfect in this. I mean, I'm sure I'll probably have other allegiances later on, but those two guys are my initial MVPs.
The behind the scenes stories of that show just kind of like enhance it so much. I think one of my favorites is like, so I believe like Glenn is at Juilliard and like Charlie Day is at university and Rob is just like sofa surfing and basically just does university by just following them to classes and just gets like a kind of a free, doesn't get a degree at the end, but he just like does a full degree by just kind of hanging out and following them to lectures.
It's also just very funny that Glenn is like a Juilliard trained actor and like this.
You can tell.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, some of the episodes that David has got to come, like it's, you're on series three now, right, David?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you've just got, I was going through the other day in the office with Adam and we were like, oh, you've got so much good stuff coming your way. the run of like series 4 to 6 or even 7.
Yeah,
like,
I think 4 is when it really hits its stride.
It's just banger after banger. I'm very happy that David is on this journey, and I'm actually thinking about doing a rewatch now because I'm at like I should be watching something I haven't seen before, but it's just such an enjoyable thing to go back and watch again, especially with like the podcast as well, because there's so many delightful stories on their podcast that they started during lockdown, which has now become this like behemoth where they do live shows and whatnot. But yeah, I'm thrilled that David is finally on this journey, because there are so many in jokes that and like quotes that will be unlocked for you.
The one I'm waiting for is I'm really excited to see the episode that contains the Charlie Day meme of him in front of the big kind of
Pepe Sylvia. It's such a good joke.
It's actually a very good, it's much more than a meme.
Yeah.
So next up, it's Hannah's pick. It's A Bigger Splash. While vacationing on a Sicilian island with her boyfriend, a rock star receives an unexpected visit from an old flame and his seductive daughter. So, Hannah, this was quite surprising that you chose it, because I believe you said, I want to do A Bigger Splash. I don't like A Bigger Splash that much.
Yeah, you know what? I actually wonder if I should maybe rewatch it after watching Challenges, because I do think I chose it because I think the two, there's like a kind of, you know, a link between the two, in that they're both kind of examining fame and love trip. Well, I mean, I guess it's like a love square in A Bigger Splash. It's a film that I remember coming out and I was just not very interested for whatever reason. I didn't get around to watching it. I can be a bit hot and cold on Ralph Fiennes. I remember thinking, like, I watched Trey and I was like, no, I don't like his vibes in this. And actually, like, watching the film, I'm like, I was correct to not like his vibes. His vibes are off in this film. But, you know, he does get his comeuppance for that quite swiftly and maybe unfairly. It's kind of loosely based on L'Apocine, which is a beloved film, certainly among a lot of my cinephile friends. And it's based, it takes its name at least from the Hockney painting, A Bigger Splash, which is one of my favourite paintings. So it's strange that I wasn't particularly interested in watching the film. But it's very much Luca Guadagnino's modus operandi. Like, it's a very beautiful film to look at and it's fun. But it's one of those films that everyone I find so, and it's the point, you're meant to find these people
pretty horrible, but I just found them, yeah, so objectionable. And the film is like very, I think, kind of miserable. After a certain point, it all gets a bit like, you know, unrelentingly like, you're like, oh, this is a downer. And sometimes I'm up for that and sometimes I'm not. And I don't know, it just kind of didn't gel for me in the way that I hoped it would. But I think certainly in terms of thinking about it in relation to challenges, it's dealing with similar dynamics, dealing with the effect of the past on the present and how old relationships kind of get their hooks into people. And, you know, you can't really avoid confronting old romances and old loves. And I think it's interesting considering like the way this works out in A Bigger Splash compared to how it works out in Challengers. I think Challengers, maybe the generational divide between the characters in Challengers and the characters in A Bigger Splash is maybe interesting to consider, because the kind of Gen X baby boomers in A Bigger Splash deal with their kind of trauma in a slightly different manner to the characters in Challengers. But then there's also, I think as well, one of the reasons the film maybe doesn't work for me is there is this kind of undercurrent of tension to do with the migrant community in Pantelleria, I think the island is called. And it's that's kind of going on in the background. And I was just like, you're doing too much here, Luca. There's too much kind of going on. But it is, yeah, it's fundamentally a film about rich people being kind of awful to each other. And I think I just find, like, I Am Love a more interesting kind of take on a sort of similar topic. But it's, yeah, it's a good one to watch, I think, in conjunction with Challengers. And it looks great. And there's a very fun use of like a Rolling Stones song in it that I remember quite fondly, when I think Ralph Fiennes is like dancing to it, because this whole thing is like he's a music producer and like worked with the Rolling Stones. And yeah, it's worth a watch. I'm not saying it's like, you know, a bad film. It's just not one that I vibe with as much from his kind of filmography.
Okay, so I mean, that's interesting that you kind of see the way that like he maybe Lucas like evolved. Watching them back to back. But also, what is, if people don't want to spend a full week entirely immersed in the world of Luca Guadagnino, what would you recommend they seek out that isn't a movie?
That is a great question. So I've been away for 2 weeks, so I haven't been watching movies, I haven't been engaging with any sort of culture apart from the culture of Japan, which is a beautiful culture to engage with. But yeah, it did kind of knock me for six, because I was like, oh crap, I haven't done anything, I haven't watched anything, I haven't done like anything that isn't just kind of holiday stuff. But I actually did start reading the novel Night Bitch when I was on holiday. I'm only about a third of the way through, so I can't, maybe I'll hate it by the end of it. But that's definitely one that I'm late to the game on. I've been meaning to read it, but it's by Rachel Yoda, and it is of course being made into a film, as is what happens to every successful novel. And it is going to have Amy Adams in it. And it's about a woman, a young woman who is, she has recently become a mother. She has, I think he's about 4 years, 3 or 4 years old, her son. And it's her struggling with becoming a new mother. And her husband is a very distant, kind of, you know, just good job, honey type of husband. And she slowly turns into a dog, hence the name Night Bitch. And yeah, I'm enjoying it a lot so far. It's kind of a weird style to get used to. It's kind of like second person, which I always find a little bit tricky to kind of grasp it with novels. But it's very funny. It's very much, if you're into like The Yellow Wallpaper or Die My Love, which is the book that's been turned into a film with Jennifer Lawrence by Lynn Ramsey. It's very much similar, like dealing with postpartum depression and kind of the restraints and restrictions placed on women when they move from being a woman in the world of their own kind of person to being a mother. And yeah, it's good. It's very dark and very funny. And I'm so excited to see how Marielle Heller has turned it into a film, because it is a bit like a bit of a batshit concept, but in a good way.
It does feel like a bit of a sort of like 30 Rock fake film.
Night Bitch. yeah. You can hear Ike Baldwin saying it.
Yeah, but I also do kind of like, I will read it because I think I need to give this like his fair chance, but like I do believe that like Darren Aronofsky's Mother squeezed every bit of joy out of the yellow wallpaper out of me.
Yes, true, true. This
so
is like,
I need to come in, really, to read the book, and I need to come in with better faith when Night Bitch premieres. I'm sorry, what a ridiculous... David, looking forward to Night Bitch?
Yeah, I think Mario Hella is a great filmmaker. So yeah, I'm definitely excited for that one. She's bangers only. So yeah.
She is, and it's very different for her as well. Like, her last film was the Mr. Rogers film, wasn't it? So yeah, I think she'll do great things. But the book is like, and it's also like the character, the lead character, who I don't think we ever learn her name. She was an artist before she was a parent, and so that is very funny as well. You know, kind of this, I don't know, shaving of the person that once you become a mother, it's like, how can you also be an artist and have time to create when you are trying to raise a human being? And just the way it talks about children is very funny, and particularly young children. And as someone without kids who probably won't ever have children, I'm just like reading it kind of like, oh, that sucks for you. It's good. It is fun, and it's not very long, and it's very like easy to kind of, you know, it's something that I could probably knock out in a week or less, but because I've been away, I haven't finished it yet. But yeah, it's good. I recommend.
Oh, thank you very much. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, Rose Glass returns with some sexy and dangerous gym nuts in Love Lies Bleeding, and I spoke to the director about her film. Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling also team up for action comedy The Fall Guy. Thanks very much for tuning in, and if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were David Jenkins and Hannah Strong. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.